Chapter 22. Besides the official verdict that Dorothy Kilgallen died accidentally as a result of acute ethanol and barbiturate intoxication, circumstances undetermined, two additional causes of death exist: suicide and murder. Is suicide possible? Could Kilgallen have taken her own life due to a depressing state of affairs, both professionally and personally? One factor to consider is the muddy state of her marriage to Richard. From it being so special, the two having been locked in a love affair for many years, the relationship had hit bottom, with daily arguments about his drinking, business failures, and nighttime adventures with women at large. The romance of the relationship had faded away. He went his way, she went hers, with the couple very rarely spending time together away from the townhouse, where they were little more than strangers. Separate sleeping quarters were the norm, passion having been drained from the relationship. Richard was dealing with a life filled with disappointment and regret. Kilgallen still had much to live for. She continued work on Murder One while still probing the JFK assassination investigation on a daily basis. A potential movie television deal was on the table, and Kilgallen was expecting photographers from 20th Century Fox to appear for a photo shoot at the townhouse on the same day she died. As part of a multi-part feature story about Kilgallen in the Journal American following her death, fellow reporter Louis Sobel wrote, "Producer Joseph E. Levine and Dorothy Kilgallen met with lawyers on Wednesday, November 3rd, about legal issues concerning Murder One becoming a television series. Apparently a six-figure option price was on the table, a hefty sum for the rights to the book. Kilgallen deciding to take her life makes little sense, since Sobel noted in his story that Kilgallen had plans to travel to London on November 11th, the Wednesday after she died. It is not known what the trip entailed, but she seemed quite excited about visiting one of her favorite cities in the world. Since Mark Sinclair and others believed the results of her 18-month JFK assassination investigation would tumble into a separate book, organizing the investigation files she kept close at hand was a priority. According to accounts from makeup man Carmen Gabia, Sinclair, Charles Simpson, Johnny Ray, and other friends, she appeared excited about the evidence she had gathered and cracking the case wide open. Kilgallen's highly anticipated second trip to New Orleans may be the strongest argument for her not being in a suicidal mode. Why would she take her life when that trip was on the near horizon, a trip she mentioned with excitement in her voice? On the personal front, the long-standing affair with singer Johnny Ray was more of a friendship than a love interest, but both she and the pop singer were satisfied with that change in the relationship. During Kilgallen's lengthy JFK assassination investigation, the two had spoken frequently, but had not been as close as before, while Ray had become enamored with his manager, Bill Franklin. Regardless, just a month before she died, Kilgallen visited Las Vegas as part of a press junket for producer Joseph E. Levine's highly criticized film, The Oscar, starring Tony Bennett. While there, she watched Johnny Ray perform, and together they enjoyed mutual friend Bennett's rendition of I Left My Heart in San Francisco, first released 3 years earlier at the Riviera Hotel. When there was time for personal chatter, Kilgallen told him of the pending trip to New Orleans. Since Kilgallen's torrid affair with Ray had cooled, and she desperately sought serious male companionship, a new romance was on the horizon with Ron Pataki, an Ohio newspaper columnist whom she had met. With Richard wallowing in self-pity as an alcoholic and not providing the sexual companionship Kilgallen required, the relationship with Pataki was a welcome addition to her life. Most importantly, those who surrounded Kilgallen, such as Sinclair and Simpson, knew she had a strong zest for life, and primary source proof of this mindset comes from What's My Line moderator John Charles Daly. The day after Kilgallen died, the shaken program moderator told reporters, "Dorothy was just full of beans last night. She was in great spirits." One only has to watch Kilgallen's final appearance on What's My Line to confirm Daly's rosy observation. Kilgallen was foiled, as were the other panel members, by a gentleman wearing a turban who owned a wax museum in Hollywood. Mystery guest actress Joey Heatherton enjoyed Kilgallen's questioning before Bennett Cerf guessed Heatherton's occupation, since his son Chris happened to be a Heatherton fan. Then, Kilgallen deftly guessed the occupation of Catherine Williams Stone, who sold dynamite, after inquiring whether the woman sold something bigger than a tiny bread box. The final contestant on the program was Eleanor Kane, now Penna, who stumped the panel and won $50 when it was learned she was a football writer. Kilgallen's bubbling personality and sense of humor shone through as the program progressed, dressed as she was in a fashionable, low-cut dress with her trademark pearls in full view. Next to her sat the witty Tony Randall, later to achieve immortal fame on the program The Odd Couple with Jack Klugman. Regarding Kilgallen's physical presence, there is no evidence of her hands shaking or the slurring of words. When she was introduced at the beginning of the show, Kilgallen stood tall and her step was lively as she walked to where she sat beside Randall. Near the end, she and Bennett Cerf bantered in fun at his sarcastic sense of humor. During his videotaped interview, Mark Sinclair defended Kilgallen's character, addressing specifically the allegations that she had a drug and alcohol problem. "They'd like you to believe that. They'd like you to believe she drank. She did drink. She was a tough lady. She was able to go out with gangsters and people like that, so she had to be like that. But how could she do the body of work that was done, that everybody professes to, that you can find on tapes, and be an alcoholic and a pill pusher? How do you do that, and she's on television 3 or 4 times a week? How do you do this without someone knowing?" Regarding the program's producers' reaction if they had suspicions of misconduct on Kilgallen's part, Sinclair stated, "They would have taken her off the air immediately. They couldn't have let her on drunk." Later in the interview, Sinclair added, "Go look at the tapes a week before she died. She looks beautiful. She's walking around, looks beautiful. I had dinner with her twice that week. I went out for cocktails with her twice that week. She had a limo driver who knew her. The people in the restaurants knew her. People at the theater knew her. How do you hide this pill and drug habit that they say she had?" Asked if Kilgallen's face was puffy, her figure shot, Sinclair said, "You can look at the tapes. Was she bloated? Was her figure gone? No. She wore a form-fitting dress. She looked beautiful." An additional primary source who speaks to Kilgallen's mental and physical condition just hours before she died is Dave Spiegel, a New York City-based Western Union office manager. Bob Considine of the Hearst newspaper syndicate first quoted him a few days after Kilgallen's death. "Miss Kilgallen called me at 2:20 in the morning. She sounded great, as usual. She said, 'Good morning, Mr. Spiegel. This is Dorothy Kilgallen. Would you send a messenger over to the house to pick up my column and take it to the Journal American? I'll leave it in the regular place in the door.' I said, 'It's a pleasure,' and sent the messenger. It, the column, was there, as usual." Spiegel never mentioned any abnormal behavior connected to slurred words, drunken behavior, or depressive attitude, as evidenced by her ability to tell Spiegel the column was available in the regular place. This was a metal box located just outside the front door of Kilgallen's townhouse, hidden in the shadows since there was a small entranceway from the sidewalk to the front door. Music producer D. Anthony, a close friend who was invited to Kilgallen's townhouse for Christmas parties, one was attended, he recalled, by actress Jane Mansfield, provides another indication that Kilgallen was living life to the fullest during the days before her death. Anthony, who represented artists such as Peter Frampton and Joe Cocker, said of Kilgallen, "She was the kind of friend where I didn't need to see her every day. I wanted nothing from her, and she wanted nothing from me." More importantly, Anthony reported that on the Friday before Kilgallen's death, a handwritten note was delivered to his Manhattan address. It read, according to Anthony, "You stinker. I haven't seen you in ages. Let's have lunch on Monday." Suggesting the lunch with Anthony contradicts the suggestion of suicide. Of course, Kilgallen could have hidden misery behind a cheery exterior, but anyone who knew her had to doubt that she would take her own life by ingesting a bevy of sleeping pills while being in an inebriated state. Proof of this being a ludicrous notion surfaces in an unlikely place: the preface she apparently wrote at some point for Murder One, a portion of which she apparently showed publisher Bennett Cerf on the evening of her final What's My Line program. Entitled Dorothy Kilgallen to the Reader, the text describes how Cerf, whom she once called as pleasant a slave driver as I have ever known, urged her to write the book. It read, "The result was this collection of the 6 famous murder trials that I covered as a working member of the press. One of my colleagues once called me a newspaper man in a $500 dress, but don't you believe it." Alluding to the Dr. Sam Shepard murder case, Kilgallen then proceeded to note that the Supreme Court's review of that case and any decision would not be forthcoming for several months. Then she added, "Meanwhile, the show, or in this case the book, must go on." Below this sentence were the words, "Dorothy Kilgallen, New York City, 1965. To this message, the editor, perhaps Cerf, added the following caveat. On December 8, 1965, obviously a mistake about the correct date of death, Dorothy Kilgallen passed away. Only a little while before, she had discussed with us the possibility of delaying publication of her book until the Supreme Court had disposed of the Shepard case, so that she could bring her account up to date. Since Kilgallen's preface is dated simply as New York City, 1965, there is no way to know exactly when she wrote it. Regardless, her words are ones of anticipation, not those of someone who may decide to end her life, since she knew it might take months for the Supreme Court to decide Dr. Shepard's fate. In fact, it took until June 1966 for the justices to render their decision. Carrie Colmar's tutor and family companion, Ibn Hassan, supplemented the conclusion that Kilgallen indeed had much to live for. He told this author, "Dorothy was very cheerful about life. She was working on her book, very enthusiastically. She was determined to finish it." During a 1978 interview, Hassan stated, "I was in New York City when she was working on her book in Geneva. Asked if any papers pertaining to the book were ever discovered after she died, he said, the papers were gone." While adding, Kilgallen was very, very enthusiastic about the book. Mark Sinclair said he was certain Kilgallen had not taken her own life. He stated, "Suicide is out of the question. It's just out of the question. She was Catholic, and you know what that means." Assessing the validity of the official cause of Kilgallen's death, an accidental one based on the combination of drugs and alcohol, requires common-sense reasoning, especially keeping in mind the state of the death scene at her townhouse. NYPD Detective John Doyle, the lead detective from the 19th Precinct, later said his recollections about November 8th were connected to a week when he had testified in court about a $400,000 burglary heist at NYC's Sherry Netherland Hotel and a burglary at the famous Delmonico's restaurant. In fact, Doyle said that on November 8th, he was in court mid-morning, and then at about 3 p.m., he was informed of Kilgallen's death. Doyle was upset, he noted, because of being told her body had been discovered at 1 p.m., meaning 2 hours had passed since it happened. Doyle did not know why he had not been contacted earlier, but was furious that possible forensic evidence may have been misplaced or lost during that 2-hour period. In his report, Detective Doyle stated that when he entered the residence, motion picture star Joan Crawford and Kilgallen's father Jim were present. along with Kilgallen's husband, Richard. Regarding his state of mind, Doyle said he was completely inebriated. I don't even think he knew his own name. Through slurred speech, Richard, sitting in the black room, told Doyle, "My wife fell asleep while she was reading in a half-sitting position." Doyle was curious about this statement, while recalling that the reading light next to the bed where her body was discovered was on. Detective Doyle did not address who called the medical examiner's office, and thus did not know why the medical examiner arrived from the Brooklyn branch instead of the Manhattan branch. Finally, Dr. James Luke arrived after Doyle had written in his report that there was an empty bottle of Seconal previously containing 50 100-milligram capsules on the nightstand near Kilgallen's bed. Reading the name of Hunter Pharmacy on the bottle, Doyle and his partner went to the Madison Avenue location. He must have told Dr. Luke of this visit, since the medical examiner included the information in the official medical examiner documents. Doyle later stated that Kilgallen's Seconal prescription history for the previous 3+ years indicated that she had averaged 2 pills per day. This amount was certainly not an abuse of the drug. Nothing out of the ordinary for those who battled insomnia. Later, Detective Doyle was angered when he was told that the empty vial, which should have been marked as evidence, was not delivered to the police station or the medical examiner's office. Like Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation file, the vial disappeared. In 2017, retired Dutchess County Sheriff's Office Detective Dennis O'Keefe contacted this author with information about the man he knew was Jack Popeye Doyle. O'Keefe reported that, "Jack Doyle called me before I retired and said a retired professor had tried to get a hold of him." Doyle then added, "I was a young detective and responded to the death of Dorothy Kilgallen. I filled out the death report, a DD-5 form. It also contained all of my interview notes." Apparently, the DD-5, or Detective Division 5, revealed to exist here for the first time, suggested a different cause of death than it being accidental. Visceral congestion. It is a classic symptom of drug overdoses, culminating in a bloody froth emanating from the victim's nose and mouth. Doyle reported, "All I got from the medical examiner's office was a slip of paper saying, 'Death due to visceral congestion.' No more detailed report than that. If there was any cover-up on this whatsoever, it would have been down at the medical examiner's office." He added, "They never went into detail. Had it been explained to me that there was an overly amount of barbiturates in the system, then I probably would have dug a little deeper. There was no indication at all that there was anything out of the ordinary." A medical examiner's office report, signed by Dr. James Luke, stated, "Visceral congestion is not a term I would use, and it was not the cause of death." Doyle thus dead-ended any investigation of Kilgallen's death before it started. He connected empty Seconal vial with drug overdose, and in all likelihood decided this was just another example of a celebrity who couldn't handle life in the fast lane and took her own life. With this mindset in tow, he apparently never asked questions of Kilgallen's relatives, her butler James Clement and his wife, Kilgallen's friends, her colleagues at What's My Line, no one. Doyle did not even go so far as to attempt an investigation of Kilgallen's whereabouts on the evening before her death, or during the early morning hours before her body was discovered. This meant he had no idea of her behavior during the program, at P.J. Clark's and the Regency Hotel Bar, or during the time she left that bar and returned home. To not do so was incompetent, unless Detective Doyle was instructed by others to simply go through the motions, thus blunting any chance of gathering real evidence regarding Kilgallen's death. Doyle's disregard for any investigation is more troublesome based on what Brenda DeJordan's father told her happened on the day Kilgallen died. She explained to this author, "I remember my father saying something about a policeman mentioning the word homicide. Dad told the police he heard something. Somebody could have come in the townhouse. They said no. He asked, 'Don't you want to investigate?' they said no. Curiously, within a month of Kilgallen's death, Detective Doyle, father of six children, resigned, without a pension, from the police force. He left New York City and opened Doyle's Terrace Restaurant near LaGrangeville, New York, near apple-picking country. Describing a brief interview with Doyle, a trim, blue-eyed man at the time, who favored polyester suits, researcher Catherine Faubel told this author, "He sounded to us like a tough guy from Brooklyn, Goodfellas style." Kilgallen's death was simply a blip on the screen to the authorities, but a red flag had appeared that even the young detective should have seen as a signal that there was more to Kilgallen's death than met the eye. Despite the apparent accidental overdose of drugs, Dr. Luke had ordered an autopsy, which meant that he must have suspected the potential for foul play. Whether Doyle even paid attention to Dr. Luke's decision is unknown, but it appears he did not, and simply let the case slip away into the night. Also of interest is why a young detective, the description Doyle gave to Dennis O'Keefe, was assigned to Kilgallen's case. This was a celebrity death, not your average killing in the Bronx, and yet the powers that be in the police department sent an inexperienced detective to the death scene, instead of a seasoned veteran, who would have undoubtedly taken a closer look at the facts surrounding the case and asked the questions that needed to be asked. Instead, Dr. Luke and a young detective interviewed the drunken Richard, believed him, and for some reason stopped right there, preventing any further look into the true facts of what happened to the famous reporter. Nevertheless, if one only considers the death scene as described by the eyewitnesses, Dr. Luke, Richard, and Detective Doyle, along with the physical evidence of discovering the empty Seconal vial together, and the knowledge that Kilgallen had a prescription for that drug, then, as suggested, the accidental cause of death may be viable. However, the presence of Tuenol, noted by Dr. Luke, the presence of Seconal, Nembutal, and the Tuenol, noted by John Broich, and the analysis by Dr. Baden, as confirmed by Dr. Hoffman, that Kilgallen's system contained the equivalent of 15 to 20 Seconals, throws several question marks into the equation. Three facts appear clear. One, Detective Doyle apparently never read the autopsy report, or else he would have noted the inclusion of Tuenol in Dr. Luke's notes. Two, if the autopsy report actually was passed along to Doyle, Dr. Luke deleted that page from the report the young detective received. Or three, Doyle, if he did read the autopsy report, may have been pressured or perhaps paid to disregard the mention of Tuenol, since it would have muddied Dr. Luke's official cause of death. Regarding payment, recall that Doyle somehow, despite earning only a detective salary, had enough money to open a restaurant shortly after his retirement without a pension from the police force. Bottom line. The question to answer is whether Kilgallen could have accidentally swallowed as many as the equivalent of 15 to 20 Seconals. This appears quite unlikely, since while she had the prescription for Seconal and took, according to Detective Doyle, 2 per night on average, there was no prescription for either Nembutal or Tuenol, and no evidence that she had ever ingested these barbiturates before. As her daughter Jill said, Kilgallen may have taken a sleeping pill once in a while, nothing more. This means it is logical to presume that only one possibility exists regarding the true cause of her death. Someone else was involved with Kilgallen taking the pills, and by doing so, committed murder. Of interest is that more than 10 years after Kilgallen died, a request from G. Robert Blakey, chief counsel and director of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, was received by the New York Medical Examiner's Office. The committee was charged with considering new evidence about the JFK and Martin Luther King assassinations collected since the 1960s. Blakey's request landed on the desk of Dominic J. DeMaio, M.D., chief medical examiner. Dr. DeMaio, who signed Kilgallen's death certificate, wrote back to Mr. Blakey on April 13, 1978, "Enclosed, you will find the complete file on Ms. Kilgallen, who died on November 8, 1965. A 2016 request from this author regarding the HSCA interest in Kilgallen was forwarded to Blakey. His response was most interesting. Our look into Kilgallen's death was not substantial. In any event, we thought it was fishy. But we were not able to solve it and do JKK, JFK and Martin Luther King, assassination investigation, at the same time. Blakey confirmed to this author that there is no mention of Kilgallen or what she discovered through her extensive investigation of the JFK and Oswald assassinations in the committee's final report. Any opportunity to include eyewitness accounts from one of the premier investigative reporters in history, a competent, credible journalist whose compilation of facts about what happened before, during, and after the JFK and Oswald assassinations is unmatched, had been lost. First, this had happened by those rubber-stamping J. Edgar Hoover's Oswald alone theory, including the Warren Commission, and then by another governmental agency, the HSCA.